Osiris.
Hey, this is Chris Pandolfi from the infamous String Dusters, and this podcast is part of the Osiris podcast family. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and music. Osiris works in partnership with Relix. Check them out for all kinds of new music, news, and information.
Hey, everybody. The holidays are right around the corner. What do you get the music fan who has everything? Ice cream. Ben & Jerry's has collaborated with the band Phish and the Waterwheel Foundation to create a limited edition flavor. It's ice cream. Caramel malt ice cream with almond toffee pieces, fudge fish, and a caramel swirl. The packaging and a very limited edition t-shirt were designed by Jim Pollock. A portion of the proceeds for the ice cream and all of the proceeds for the teas are donated to the Waterwheel Foundation. The ice cream and teas can be ordered at store.benjerry.com. That's store.benjerry.com. If you use the promo code Osiris, O-S-I-R-I-S, you can get free shipping on all orders over $50 for the rest of 2018. But wait, there's more. A limited edition curveball fish food waterwheel tea that was created for the canceled festival can also be purchased online. So please visit store.benjerry.com. Happy holidays.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's guest was, I have to say, quite a delight. It's Professor Eugene Rogan, who is Professor of Modern Middle Eastern History and the Director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford University in England. He came to MTSU as a part of our Strickland Scholars Program, gave an amazing talk Thursday night, and managed to work into his schedule to sit down with me and Bob to talk about the history of the modern Middle East and the ways that World War I, which led to the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire into the modern countries that we know as Syria, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, Turkey. It's really when you look back at the history of the region and the way things are today, you cannot understand the Middle East without understanding the importance here of what happened to the Ottoman Empire after World War I. It's fascinating. He's lived all over the world, Dr. Rogan has. And has some really cool stories. And by the way, there's a Grateful Dead story in here for anybody who's interested in that. It comes towards the end, but you'll love it. It really, I laughed with delight when he told me that. And it's really a great interview. I want to say a special thanks here to the Strickland family. Roscoe L. Strickland Jr., who was a professor at MTSU from 1949 until well into the 60s. He served our university. He then moved on. But when his wife passed away, his wife Lucy, who was also a faculty member at MTSU, they thought of the university and they gave money to help us provide these services. And we've brought in some great speakers through the Strickland Scholar Program. In fact, this is the third episode of The Road to Now where you're going to hear a Strickland Scholar. Our first one we had on was Arch Getty talking about Russia. Then last year we had on Nicholas Carr. And now we have Eugene Rogan. And the three of them are incredibly delightful people, great scholars, and just really great folks. And sometimes we enjoy the benefits of these things and we don't necessarily think about the past, but without the Strickland family's donation for this, MTSU and also The Road to Now wouldn't have some of these great guests we've had on. And so just want to say thank you to the Strickland family for supporting this. As we sat down here and had the interview, we had Bob over the Skype there. He was, I think, in Florida where he's playing a concert this weekend. It was really delightful because he sat here and he wanted a cup of coffee and I cooked him up some La Cosecha coffee. And he just sent me a thank you email, which included an email that said, thank you, the coffee was great. So there you go. As I said, we take on sponsors that we believe in and we served it to our guests back here at our house and it was awesome. As you'll hear, I got to spend the day with Dr. Rogan. We went to the Ryman Auditorium. Then we went and had some hot chicken after the interview. But it was great. And so I hope you guys will enjoy this episode. As I said, you really can't understand the Middle East today if you do not understand the history here. And certainly World War I and the division of the Ottoman Empire after that is essential. So we hope you enjoy our interview with Dr. Eugene Rogan on the history of the Middle East and the division of the Ottoman Empire. Thank you. We're here with Dolph Ramsor, who you may know as the sponsor of our podcast, the original sponsor of our podcast, the godfather of North Carolina music.
Dolph being a sponsor of our show literally helps us keep the lights on, keeps batteries in the Zoom recorder, keeps the microphone cables working. Dolph, we appreciate all your support over the past year.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
We've been running an ad for the Ruin Brothers, which is one of the new albums that came out that you guys put out, but was produced by Rick Rubin, correct?
Correct. Correct.
I texted Dolph after the second time we ran it and told him that I've never seen a more effective advertisement because it had worked on my entire family. Because after I heard that ad on my own podcast a couple times when I was editing it, my wife listens to the Ruin Brothers all the time now, and I've listened to that album several times. It worked on us, man.
Well, that's great to know. That's great. And they're such talented guys, and they're sweet fellas as well. They're from the north of England, Scunthorpe, which is a very working class area, but they're really good guys.
Dolph, you have a few newer groups on your roster. Is there anybody that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, we just signed a band called Sammy Miller and the Congregation, and that's a unique one because it's a jazz band, and this is the first jazz band I have worked with. But they're a very unique band because it's kind of joyful jazz. They do a lot of comedy bits within the jazz that they play. It's really unique. It's almost very much like early Avett Brothers when you had to go see the band to sort of get it.
So yeah, so we're grateful we had you as sponsors, and as I said the first time we had you on the introduction, maybe over a year ago, and I said that I've known Dolph over a decade, and he's only ever sponsored really good things and put his name behind really good things, and I didn't know if this was going to be the one that broke him, and I didn't want to be a part of it, but a year later we're still going and we're thankful for it.
Well, again, glad to be a part of it, and y'all keep rocking. I'll keep rocking and having some fun doing it.
Big team, little me.
Yes.
That's right. So check out the Ruin Brothers album and all the other albums and the bands on Ramsor Records. You can go to ramsorrecords.com. And you can, if you're interested in any of the albums there, you can enter the promo code HISTORY and get 10% off. So go do it. Show Dolph some love, and we're thankful for him.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. I think it's important, and I've asked a lot of our guests this, we don't have a 100% academic audience, so I think it's important to go back and really let people understand what was the Middle East like 100 years prior to World War One. You know what I'm saying? Like really set the table for
them. You want me to do it in sort of dialectical materialistic way where we have a Foucauldian interpretation overlaid with certain Lacanian, because I think that the general public really goes to that kind of approach. What do you think?
Gee, you already sound like one of Ben's academic elite jerk friends. So
I count myself lucky.
Yeah. And we're in my home right now, Bob. So I've got home field advantage. Also, Eugene is drinking La Cosecha coffee.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Here's one for the sponsors.
Thank you so much, Eugene. Well, it's a real thrill to have you on the show. I feel very fortunate to have you as a guest.
Yeah, but tell me the truth. You say that to all the boys, right?
Not really. Normally, when it's a friend of Ben's, it's like, okay, great. Whatever, Ben. But that's good. It's really, really glad to have you on.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, with all that said, Eugene Rogan, welcome to The Road to Now.
It is great to be with you.
Eugene's here in Nashville. We're at my house. I just took him on the tour of the Ryman Auditorium, and you learned something about country music.
You took me on a tour of the Ryman at your guest's request. I was coming to Nashville, and I wanted to see the heartland of country music, and that was the place to be.
Dr. Rogan, you can't get any closer to the heart of country music music history than to visit the Ryman. You chose well.
More than that, I've never liked country music. And one morning in the Ryman, and I'm really, really looking to listen to a lot of music. So it converts the, unconverted.
Yeah, yeah. It's a missionary mission.
Absolutely.
It's right in there. Also, I was proud to tell Eugene that, Bob, both of us have performed on stage at the Ryman, and that makes me sound way too much like a peer of yours. I'm not.
Dr. Rogan, Ben did perform at the Ryman, and it was just, he did a great job by all accounts, and he received a lot of acclaim for it. But, I performed on the stage of the Ryman dressed in a mariachi costume after which I ran off the stage, got in a car, and drove 14 hours to my daughter's birth. So I think I've got listening to, and I would recommend if you want to get into country music, Kris Kristofferson's Borderlord album, listening to that on repeat the whole way. So I have been beat as far as the Ryman experience goes. And there's a lot of things I don't have over Ben, but I have that, and I'm going to hold on to that.
Okay, but here's a little trivia binding Oxford to Nashville, which is that Kris Kristofferson was a Rhodes Scholar.
That's
so he came
right.
and studied at Oxford. And when they did the centenary of the Rhodes Scholarships, he came back and kind of sung for the old guys coming together to celebrate 100 years of that good scholarship program.
That's amazing. And here's a way to link that to us. Bob is playing with Kris Kristofferson at the Bridgestone Arena on June 12th or January 12th for the Willie Nelson 85th anniversary party.
Yeah, we're very excited. That's going to be one of those just things you can't believe you get to do.
Okay, and Bob, one last thing before we get down to the serious stuff here is, can we drop the doctor part? You can just call me Eugene.
Yeah, here's the thing. You worked hard for that title.
Yeah, but it was so long ago now that it's like all paid off. I don't have to trade on that anymore.
All right, Eugene, you win.
Thank you.
Before we get started too, Bob, I'd like to demand that you call me Dr. Sawyer. By your own reasoning. I'm just kidding.
Silence on the other end of the line.
Anyway, Eugene, we've had have you here because you're an expert on the Middle East. You've published multiple books, which I always love whenever, like, you know, this hasn't only happened a few times, but like we have you on the podcast. You're here for the Strickland Scholar talk. You're our third consecutive Strickland Scholar. It's a great program at Middle Tennessee State University. And so I don't want to start without saying thank you to the Roscoe Strickland and his family for sponsoring that. But this is the thing where I told Bob, I was like, we can get Eugene Rogan on the podcast. Let's do it. And he said, I read one of his books already. So usually we're reading books to prepare. Bob had already read it. Your specialty is the Middle East. Right now, the United States is has involved in Iraq. Syria has been on our radar. Yemen, things have been going on in Yemen. We obviously have a close relationship with Israel. And so a lot of our focus, foreign policy focus, has been on that region. Could you go back and tell us, how is it that the United States becomes involved? And even before that, how is it that the Ottoman Empire, this giant empire, becomes the modern states that are today the Middle East?
Well, you're definitely right, Ben. I mean, America has a very big footprint in the Middle East today. And if you go back 100 years ago, it wasn't the case. America was still pretty isolationist in worldview, had just been drawn into the First World War, not a popular choice with most Americans. They only got into the First World War in April of 1917. And even then, though the Ottomans were on Germany's side, America never went to war with the Ottoman Empire. America had kept all of its embassies and consulates right across the Ottoman Empire open. And so they had, as a neutral power, kept a very positive line of communication with the Ottoman Empire. And what that meant was, as the war was coming to an end, a lot of people in the Arab world looked on America as a friend and maybe someone who would uphold the interest of Arab people against other imperial powers who, as the Ottomans lost the war and were falling, wanted to carve up their land and take over, particularly the British and the French.
And just to start off and go back further, I guess, the first question maybe I should have asked was, could you explain what the Ottoman Empire was and how it originated and kind of where it stood in the world as of the beginning of World War One?
Yeah, it's true. It's not a household name, the Ottoman Empire. and it was such an important historic player from its rise in the 13th century right down to its fall in the early 20th century that we should know about it. Basically, the Ottomans were an Islamic empire of Turkish-speaking people who came in from Central Asia to conquer their way into what was then the Christian Empire of Byzantium. And the Muslim world ran right through the Arab lands and Iran at that time. But if you look at what's now Turkey, heading right to the Mediterranean, that was all under a kind of Greek Orthodox Christian empire known as the Byzantine Empire. And basically the growth of the Ottomans was always at the expense of the Byzantines, right until they conquered the Byzantine capital city of Constantinople in 1453 and made that their capital city.
Yes, and my friend and our patron, Tim Wells, wanted to make sure I give a shout out to the They Might Be Giants song even Istanbul.
Wait, that song goes back way, way before They Might Be Giants. But to Tim's point, I think that they have one of the better versions of it. But that song goes back to the 20s or 30s, actually.
So this group that establishes the Ottoman Empire, they're able to make headways into what is Europe, right? They take what year do they take Constantinople?
1453. That marks when they really become a power that straddles Asia and Europe. And it just keeps growing from there. I mean, if you look into the 15th, 16th, 17th century, you would have found Europeans more frightened of the Ottoman Empire than any other power in the Mediterranean world.
So they're on the move, and at this point in the 15th, 16th century, people are terrified. I remember from my modern Middle East class forever ago, they were on the verge of taking over almost all of Europe, correct? But their campaign strategy was seasonal. Is this right? Do I remember that right?
Their campaign strategy was seasonal. That was absolutely true. They basically started with the horses around Constantinople, and they could campaign as far as those horses could get. And the argument was they probably couldn't get much further than the suburbs of Vienna. So the expansion of the Ottoman Empire into Europe stops at the gates of Vienna. They never get further than that. But they do manage to conquer their way right through all of the Arab world, that back in the 1500s, and extend their power right across North Africa. So pretty much half the Mediterranean was under the Ottoman Empire right up until the 19th century.
To set this up here, you know, maybe some people listening don't know this, but the Ottoman Empire was ruled by Turks, and they are an ethnic group that is not the same as Arabs. Could you talk about the origins of the Turks? How did those two different groups come together there? Obviously, the campaign and the conquest of the territory, but like, where do the Turks originate and how do they move into the region?
Well, it's the stuff of myths, and the Turks have been putting out a lot of myths about their own origins, but usually say they are a Central Asian people. So if you're thinking about the Mongol hordes and Genghis Khan and all of that, this is meant to be the same stock. The interesting clue is, where's the Turkish language from? And when people talk about what's related to Turkish, they'll point to similarities with language as far away as Finnish or Japanese. So it's kind of hard to say with any precision just where the Turks came from, but they are definitely a distinct ethnic group. They speak the Turkish language, and they're different from Iranians or Persians. They're different from Arabs. They're different from Kurds. They are their own nation.
Right. That has always fascinated me, the way that the language of the Turks ties back to Japanese and Finnish. What's the speculation about this, by the way? What do people understand now about that?
You know, one thing you learn as an academic is not to go beyond your own comfort zone. And when it comes to like the origins of the Turkish language and how we can link it to Japanese, you know, I'm not your man.
Hey, so if I could just break in here.
Yeah, hop in.
You know, at this point we are at, we're talking about the origin of the Turks, which is going to be essential to the later part of our conversation. I feel like the Kurds are also going to play a role in the later part of our conversation. So where do the Kurds enter the picture?
Well, the Kurds are just another ethnic group that are in the kind of Caucasus region, so eastern Turkey. And today, Kurds live within the boundaries of four states: Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And if you like, they are, as a people, one of the victims of the state-making that went on at the end of the First World War. I mean, in the peace treaty with the Ottoman Empire, jump a little ahead in our conversation, there was some allowance for creating a Kurdish state. But at that point, it was coming at a time where I don't think the Kurds had really organized a separate national identity or movement. They'd always been pretty privileged in the Ottoman Empire, as Sunni Muslims like the Turks spoke Turkish as well as Kurdish. They were pretty well integrated, so they weren't necessarily looking to break from the Ottoman world. But when the boundaries went down, it carved up the Kurds, as I said, between four states, and I think they've been struggling against that ever since. But you're right to point out another totally distinct national and ethnic group in the Middle East, the Kurds.
It's interesting because it seemed like all these distinct ethnicities got swept up and pulled into the Ottoman Empire, correct?
It's one of the things that distinguished the kind of multinational empires like the Romanovs in Russia, or the Habsburgs and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Ottomans. And these were all empires that brought people together across huge landmass. So lots of different nationalities, ethnicities, religions, languages, made them really difficult places to rule because you had a dominant elite and then a lot of minorities. And the minorities increasingly in the 19th century thought they might be better off pursuing their own national destiny by separating from the empire in a nationalist movement. And that's going on in the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. It's what gives rise to that volatile Balkan region. And I think that both the Austro-Hungarians and the Russians suffer their own pressures from minority communities in their just very diverse empires.
Right. And the only one to manage to hold the borders together afterwards, for the most part, are the Russians. Austria-Hungary after World War I becomes Czechoslovakia and parts of Poland. And Ottoman Empire obviously becomes these multiple states in the Middle East. So this gap between when the Ottoman Empire is at its height, and then by World War I, it's referred to, the beginning of World War I in 1914, it's referred to as the sick man of Europe. What was going on inside of the Ottoman Empire that led it from this amazing, you know, this amazing force on the global scene to an increasingly emaciated, if you will, competitor for power?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, I challenge the idea that the Ottomans were such a sick man. I think in their own terms, they had been upgrading the way they ruled the empire and the deal that they dealt to their subjects. I mean, I think it was better to be in the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century than it would have been, say, in the 18th or 17th. But the real challenge for the Ottomans was everyone around them was progressing at a much faster rate. So you talk about Ottoman decline. The Ottomans weren't declining in their own terms, but they were being left behind by the neighbors. And their neighbors were growing increasingly powerful militarily. The Ottomans start losing wars in the late 1600s, and they really don't win them after that. And in the process, you know, between national movements in their own frontiers or the expansion of European empires, they're finding their territory being whittled down by Russia, by France, by Britain, until it's coming down to a core of basically the Arab lands and the Turkish lands. And that would be the Ottoman Empire at the outbreak of World War I. You'd really say it was the Middle East and Turkey, as we know it now, was the Ottoman Empire.
And so the Ottoman Empire ended up joining in an alliance with Germany and Austria-Hungary during World War I, this kind of core of the force that England, France, and Russia are fighting against. We later come on, as you said, this is something I learned from your talk the other night. I didn't realize that the United States never declared war on the Ottoman Empire, yet it was an ally of our, you know, our enemies in the war, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians. It begins to realize that it's going to lose this war as well. It begins to realize towards the end of the war that it's not winnable. There are uprisings inside of the Ottoman Empire. You spoke about towards the end of the war, there was a recognition by the Ottoman state that it was probably going to be taken apart. And you said there were two main reasons for this and this realization at the end. Could you talk about those two?
Yeah, the first thing to say is the Ottomans were seen as being so much weaker than their enemies in World War I, that the British and the French and the Russians all assumed that with the first shove, the sick man was going to fall. And the sick man proved to be a lot more tenacious. They fought a full four-year war in which they defeated the British in Gallipoli as well as in Iraq and drove them back from the gates of Gaza two times in southern Palestine. So the Ottomans proved to be tenacious old birds. And the sick man showed a vigor and vitality that I think surprised everybody. And by the time you got to 1918, there was even hope that they might be on the winning side, because in the spring of 1918, Germany had made a big breakthrough and was pushing the British and French back on the Western Front. And Russia had succumbed to a revolution, and the Bolsheviks had taken power, and they signed a peace treaty with the Germans coming out of the war. And in a sense, the Russians had been the scariest threat for the Ottomans going into the war. With Russia out, Germany on the move, and Britain and France being held in the Arab lands, they actually had reason to think, even as late as 1918, they might come out the winners. And they fought like tooth and nail right up until the British make their final breakthrough in Palestine and then just come galloping through Syria. And there, by October of 1918, they know they're licked. They know they're going to go and face total surrender. And that's when they know that in losing this war, they're going to face a constellation of forces for their punishment and carve up like they'd never known before.
And what were the two main sources of that?
Yes, we want to come back to the two main sources.
Because this was so good. It clicked in my head when you talked about this way.
Well, it helps to make a lecture that has a couple of points that people can click on. So for the benefit of listeners, the two things that really had the Ottomans concerned was, one, they knew that they were going to be taken to task for what was then termed the massacre of Armenians. We would now talk about the Armenian genocide, but the word hadn't been invented yet. And this was something that actually the Americans played a really important role in bringing to the world's attention. This, as I said before, the fact that the Americans weren't at war until 1917, that right through the initiation of the Armenian genocide, you had American consular officials who were eyewitnesses to what was happening to the Armenians, reporting this back to their ambassador, a very influential man named Henry Morgenthau, who made this one of his causes as American ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, newspapers were running stories about the Armenian massacres in the States. I think the figure I quoted was the New York Times published 140 in the year 1915 alone.
Yes.
So the Turks knew they were in for exemplary punishment for having committed crimes against humanity. And they had to control the damage from that. That was one. And two, they knew for certainty that the Allies in the course of World War I had been making very concrete plans to kill the sick man and to dismember him. And that's the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Everything else that went on between the British, French, and Russian, planning for the carve-up of the Ottoman Empire after its defeat.
I love what you said in the lecture where you said, because you talked about they found out about it when the Bolsheviks took over and broadcast these secret treaties across the world. And you described the revelation of the Sykes-Picot Treaty as the Bolshevik version of WikiLeaks.
It was absolutely the Bolsheviks' WikiLeaks moment. They just did a big data dump. They took all of the treaties that the Tsar's government had concluded with their buddies and used it to discredit the ancien regime that they had just rather bloodily overturned. And for the Ottomans, it was really eye-opening stuff because it was published in Pravda. It was immediately translated into English by the Manchester Guardian. And, you know, the news made its way right around the world in no time flat. In November 1917, everyone knew for sure. And then also that month, the beginning of November 1917, very publicly, Britain promised to make a Jewish national home in Palestine in the Balfour Declaration. So the Ottomans were in no doubt that in losing this war, as they were heading to the peace conference, they were going to be facing very hostile, victorious powers who were going to carve up their territory. And their task was to try and satisfy international outrage over the Armenians so that that issue wasn't used as a pretext for punishing them and try and keep the Europeans from acting on the partition diplomacy that they had negotiated through the course of the First World War. And as I said in the lecture, they failed.
Yeah.
You know, it's as Americans, as English speakers, it's easy for us to read historical accounts of American soldiers or British soldiers and their personal letters home. When you did your research, you read a lot of diaries of Ottoman soldiers. What differences would you say you found in the actual research for your book, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire, when it came down to the individual soldier level, not the general or the politician, but the individual Ottoman soldier? You know, we've already established they came from many different ethnicities. What was something interesting that you discovered about them personally?
Well, it was a really important goal of the book to try and capture the experience of the war in the Middle East from both sides of the trenches. And you're right, we've got so many archives that hold the letters and diaries of soldiers from Britain and America, and they were really great sources. There's less material by the average Turkish soldier. Most Turks were illiterate. Literacy in Turkey at that time was under 10%. So really only the officers tended to be educated to the extent that they could leave written records. And but there's been a real growth industry in Turkey of publishing the diaries that family members have been passing down and never made their way into archives. And so in writing the book, I drew on, you know, 20 or 30 such diaries from pretty much every one of the fronts of the Ottoman Empire. And they just added important details. I mean, to give you an idea of a discovery, there was one by a corporal who'd served in the medical corps. And I think he captured better than any source I ever read the growing antagonism that the average Turk felt towards the Armenians as a potential fifth column. He describes a growing anger at disloyalty by Armenians. He talks about how accidents were happening among the troops where Turkish soldiers' guns suddenly mysteriously discharged in the direction of an Armenian soldier. No one's ever punished for Armenian soldiers who are being killed on the Ottoman side. So, you know, that kind of visceral hatred. He even takes to his work as an orderly in the Ottoman hospitals. And as his hatred of Armenians develops, he talks about poisoning Armenians in his care and stuff. I don't know if he ever acted on that, but I think that kind of writing captures at the kind of grassroots level what might have been the public feelings that lay behind the Armenian genocide. So Etty's diary is really important for that. Otherwise, what really was striking to me is that life was pretty much the same, equally horrible on both sides of the trenches. And it's more the commonalities, the parallels between what, say, Turkish soldiers and British soldiers were writing about Gallipoli. And if anything, they found it tough to hate each other. And so you have all these really nice accounts of, in lulls in the fighting, how they would kind of throw treats at each other. And the Turks would throw cigarettes or nuts into British lines. The British would retaliate by throwing pots of jam back. And they liked each other's treats. They noted how they never took the opportunity to then lob a hand grenade where they just threw a pot of jam. It was like, it was genuine. And I think that the fact that these guys really never developed a deep hatred for each other, don't get me wrong, they fought like hell. They desperately tried to kill each other in battle. But in the quieter moments, they must have asked themselves what they were doing there and why do they want to kill the people on the other side? They both felt that. And so in that sense, I think the Turkish diaries have a lot to contribute to humanizing that war.
So this war happens, that, you know, it ends. And as you mentioned before, there is the time that it gets divided up. And what was the Ottoman Empire becomes today Iraq, Syria, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon. I mean, all of these states that we hear about a lot. How did that process go down?
Well, the final divvying up of Ottoman territory was really conducted by Britain and France. Russia, since its revolution, had withdrawn from any claims on other people's territory. It was, again, part of the kind of Bolshevik moral high ground of following up on their digital dump of Tsarist documents. And so it was the British and French, and really what they were trying to do was strike a balance of power between the British and French empires so that coming out of the victory as allies, they wouldn't then succumb to imperial squabbles over territory in the Eastern Mediterranean. They met in San Remo in 1920, and they agreed how they would carve up the Arab lands of the Ottoman Empire. And then they drew in their other wartime allies, the smaller allies like Italy and Greece, and promised them territory in what is now Turkey. And this becomes the framework of the terms dealt to the Ottoman Empire, the last of the defeated parties in the First World War to get their peace treaty. That was the Treaty of Sèvres. They got it in the summer of 1920. And it was pretty shockingly bad news for the Ottoman government. They basically saw all of their Mediterranean coastline given away to Greece, Italy, France. They found the Caucasus region being given away to create states or autonomous zones for the Armenians and Kurds. And even the capital city, Constantinople, and the Straits were sort of put under an international commission, Istanbul, given to the Turks on condition that they abide by pretty much every article of the Treaty of Sèvres that left them the rump of the Ottoman Empire, those bits of Turkey that nobody else wanted in Ankara and the Black Sea coastline. And that was the bitter pill that the Ottomans had to swallow as the price of defeat. Not so different from what, let's say, Germany suffered in the Treaty of Versailles or what Austria suffered in the Treaty of Saint-Germain, which, you know, each of the defeated parties had their own very draconian peace treaty. The Ottomans didn't get off lightly.
Let's talk about the actual carving up, right? Present-day borders, because they've largely held in 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, the boundaries of the Middle East have proven pretty enduring over the past 100 years. But so too are the conflicts that resulted from the way those boundaries were drawn. I mean, if you just, we talked about the Kurds before, look at the way the Kurds found themselves now divided into four different countries. They're a minority in each of them. Each of their host countries has, for the past 100 years, pretty much denied them their cultural rights. They certainly denied them their national rights. And the Kurds today probably have developed the institutions of statehood better in northern Iraq than anywhere in the past 100 years. But when they tried to act on that with a referendum 18 months ago, calling for independence in northern Iraq, they realized that, you know, they had to back down. They have too many enemies for that project. The Turks would be after them because they want to suppress Kurdish nationalism in Turkey. The Kurds in Syria are deeply mired in a war against ISIS and against this Assad regime. And there's very little contact with Kurds in Iran who've suffered their own repression as well. So too many enemies to act on their national aspirations. The Kurds remain kind of stateless people 100 years after the end of the First World War.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Ben.
As all our listeners know, we don't really like each other very much at all. We have to find things that we both like to talk about those things. And one of the things that we both like is ice cream.
Yeah, history and ice cream, that's about all we have going for us. You don't even like coffee, so we don't have that to rally around together. But ice cream, this is great because my favorite brand of ice cream is Ben & Jerry's. And they are collaborating right now with the band Fish and the Waterwheel Foundation to create a limited edition flavor. It's ice cream. If you're a fan of the band, you get the pun. It's a caramel malt ice cream with almond toffee pieces, fudge fish, and a caramel swirl.
And it's so great. I mean, like, you guys know from the show, we've been doing this show for 2.5 years, 100 and something episodes, over 100 episodes. We haven't had that many sponsors. We've only worked with people that we like what they do and what they make. And we love Ben and Jerry's, so this is amazing. And you can help out that charity as well. You can help us out. The Osiris Network is bringing this in. If you want to try this ice cream, you can also get this, which is limited edition. You can get it along with a very limited edition t-shirt that's designed by Jim Pollock, the famous artist of many fish covers. And a portion of the proceeds for the ice cream and all of the proceeds for the teas are donated to the Waterwheel Foundation. You can get this. And if you want to go to store.benjerry.com, Ben & Jerry's website, obviously, for the rest of 2018, you can get free shipping on any orders over $50 if you use the promo code OSIRIS, O-S-I-R-I-S.
Yeah, you know, and I will definitely, my order will be over $50 because this is what, when I go to a holiday party, this is what I'm bringing with me. Some people bring a bottle of wine, they bring a six-pack of beer. I'm bringing It's Ice Cream. I'm going to support the band Fish, but most importantly, the Waterwheel Foundation. So that is store.benjerry.com.
Bob, are you going to be like the person that brings like their favorite beer to a party and then they get there and they're like, hey, can we open those? And then they drink their own thing they brought?
Yeah, of course I am. I mean, I will be.
I brought some ice cream. Let's not let it melt, guys. Pop that open.
Hi, I'm Bob Crawford of the Avett Brothers. And if you can tell by the sound of my voice, I'm in a tour bus right now. I'm in the back of the tour bus. You know what's hard to do when you're in a tour bus? Order contact lenses. Well, Simple Contacts has me covered. They've got you covered. I love when I discover companies that can solve those pesky problems that we all have to deal with in life. And Simple Contacts is a total game changer for anyone who wears contact lenses. Listen, if you wear contact lenses, then you know how annoying it is to have to get a prescription year after year just to be able to buy more contacts. Well, Simple Contacts is changing all that by using technology to make renewing your prescription and buying contacts, well, simple. Here's how it works. Using your phone or computer, you can take the Simple Contacts vision test in 5 minutes and literally anywhere. You can take it from anywhere. I could do it in the back of the bus right now. You could do it from your couch, from the airport, wherever, your office. Then a real doctor reviews your test in 24 hours, and if your vision hasn't changed, he writes you a new prescription. Boom, you're done. Fresh supply of contact lenses is on the way to your door. No more appointments, no more waiting rooms, no more overpaying. Simple Contacts brings the doctor's office to wherever you are. whenever you need it so you can skip the office visit, but not the care. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes for a great price. They do all the hard work for you. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses at amazing prices. The prescription is just $20. The contact lens prices are unbeatable. There are never any hidden fees, and shipping is free. Best of all, Road to Now listeners get $20 off their first Simple Contacts order. To save $20 on your lenses, just go to simplecontacts.com/roadtonow, R-O-A-D-T-O-N-O-W, Road to Now, or enter the code Road to Now at checkout. I also want to mention that this isn't a replacement for your full eye health exam. You still need to do those occasionally, but it is the most convenient way to renew a prescription or reorder your contacts if your vision hasn't changed. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $20 off your first order by going to simplecontacts.com/roadtonow or just enter the code roadtonow at checkout. Give it a try. Thank me later. Happy holidays.
So why don't we move over now to the Palestinians, and because that they are still affected by decisions that were made post World War One in the reshaping of the Middle East. Maybe talk a little bit about how they were handled as the region was being carved up.
If you look back to the First World War, I mean the idea that the Palestinians were a separate people or Palestine was a separate country was only just emerging in the course of Sykes-Picot, where Britain and France and Russia were negotiating how to carve up the Arab lands. And they all, for their own reasons, wanted or had claims on the holy places in Palestine, Bethlehem, Nazareth, Jerusalem in particular. And since they couldn't agree, they took that part of the map, that part of Greater Syria, and just painted it brown. Brown because it wasn't red like what was going to Britain or blue like what was going to France. And I think for the British, they didn't see a strategic interest in Palestine until they later in the war had to fight their way through Sinai and took on the Ottomans in Palestine. You see, as long as you had a hostile party in Palestine, they would be able to encroach on the Suez Canal. The Turks did it twice in the First World War. The second time they did it, they just rolled artillery within 5 miles of the canal. And they sank some ships from that distance. You realized you couldn't protect the canal if you didn't control southern Palestine. And so suddenly, in 1916, 1917, Britain begins to take a strategic interest in Palestine, and having it internationalized doesn't suit their interests. So here's the question. How do you renegotiate this careful balance of territory with France without totally annoying them? You don't say you're taking Palestine for your own imperial interest. You say you're doing it for the moral high ground of restoring the Jewish people to their biblical homeland. As I argue in my book, it looks very much like Britain is promising Palestine to the Zionists. But trust me, it's Britain using Zionism as a way to grab Palestine for themselves. And they had expected to keep Palestine in their empire, an empire they thought was going to last a very long time. And the people that lived in the boundaries of that place, they didn't think of as a separate national people. They just saw them as Christians and Muslims. And they were going to add Jews to the formula and have a holy land of Christians, Muslims, and Jews, the three faiths who viewed Jerusalem as their holy city. They thought they could manage that really well because they had so much imperial experience. They were good managers. What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, wow. But there were Jewish people living in that area before, right?
I mean, there were.
Under Ottoman rule.
There were, but they were a minority of about under 5%. So it really was a small Jewish community before you started getting Zionist immigration to Palestine after 1882. And even then, by the time you get to World War I, the Jewish population of Palestine is well under 10%.
Okay. I remember learning just the way that nationalism comes to affect that relationship because it was a long time ago, but reading about the fact that the people make this statement, you know, well, Jews and the Arabs been fighting each other for, you know, since Bible times, you know, but it's like they weren't fighting each other whenever they lived side by side under the Ottoman Empire, were they?
No. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies for the Arab world that they don't recognize is that as a result of nationalism and all the Arab-Israeli wars, that cities that had really diverse communities of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. I'm talking about Baghdad, Damascus, Aleppo, Cairo, Alexandria. These cities were special because they had really diverse populations. I mean, in Iraq, the Jewish community was huge in Baghdad. And the singers, the musicians, the financiers, the merchants, you know, Jews were incredibly influential in all walks of Baghdadi life. And as a result of Arab-Israeli conflict and nationalism, they were no longer at home in these places and they have left. But that's a 20th century phenomenon. Before that, yeah, you know, I think Judaism had its place in the Middle East and it was a better Middle East for it.
You talked about this, you know, the lines that we're living with right now in the Middle East, they're drawn after World War One. They're largely, you know, the British and the French casting their imperial ambitions upon an entire territory without even really calculating what might happen with nationalism. They think, as you said in the talk, they think these, you know, the imperial system is going to last forever and they know how to carve things up and take this and conquer it. And then that changes. But the British and the French, their role in the Middle East kind of dilutes a bit after World War II. And then the United States becomes an important player in that region after World War II in a way it hadn't been before. How does the United States come to be this power in the region and kind of supplant the British in particular?
Well, the United States had always based its diplomacy on a kind of anti-imperial framework. And that became really pronounced in the period between the First and Second World Wars. And by the end of the Second World War, the Americans looked on their allies and basically said, the imperial age is over. You know, we are now, after 1946, facing a new order that's going to be shaped by our rivalry with the USSR. That will come to be known as the Cold War. And we're going to have to reorient our priorities and our strategies to try and contain the Soviet Union from expanding into parts of the globe where we have influence. And Asia and Africa are in the game. And we're not going to be able to keep them in the game if we fight nationalism. So we've got to work with the nationalists. You got to give up on your imperial claims. It all comes to head in sort of American-British relations in 1956 over the Suez Crisis, right. You know, where Britain is basically trying to topple the revolutionary president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, in alliance with so Britain is doing this in alliance with France and Israel because they think that his nationalization of the Suez Canal is threatening their geostrategic interests. But by 1956, you know, India is independent.
Right.
The Suez Canal is the vital strategic waterway to nowhere.
Right.
And the Americans cannot believe that just as you have the Hungarian crisis unfolding, the first crack in Soviet control in Eastern Europe, Britain and France are giving the Soviets perfect cover by engaging in a tripartite collusion with Israel to invade Egypt unprovoked to right. topple Nasser. So at that point, yeah, you can see where America was going to begin to displace Britain, whose judgment it called into question, and impose the rules of the Cold War, which are going to be the determining great power game from the 1950s right through until the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990-91.
So someone asked you this at the talk the other night, and I liked your answer a lot. So I'm going to ask it here. What can this history teach the United States in our, I'm going to ask you in a loaded way. Basically, he asked you, what could this teach us about how we should make decisions about the Middle East? And your response was, I don't know that we have a particularly good track record.
We certainly, the West does not have a great track record for drawing maps in the Middle East.
You basically said, maybe what we should do is let the decisions happen without us making them for other people.
And I still stand by that. I just think the only way you're going to resolve the many crises that are absolutely shredding the Middle East today, and let's be clear about that. The region is in a state of conflict like I have never seen in my adult life. As a historian, I cannot point to a time where there have been more fires burning across the region. But these are conflicts that now are very much made by actors in the region themselves. I mean, yes, America and their ally Britain plays a huge role for the instability in Iraq because of our 2003 invasion. You know, we basically brought down a very dictatorial regime and wrecked that state. But we don't have a great track record of state building under those circumstances. And what's followed in Iraq has been extraordinarily unstable. But I think today, Iraqis are electing their government. And if there are problems in Iraq, you know, it's Iraqis who are going to have to solve it. We're there to help. We have a responsibility and we've got a role to play. But I just don't think that that role is going to be us going in, drawing new maps, trying to impose new boundaries, trying to create a Sunnistan and Kurdistan and Shiistan in Iraq and say that that's going to work better than what they got now. I feel like we're going to have to work with the people of the region, consult with them, help them come to conflict resolution and state building on their own terms, or else we're just going to repeat the mistakes of the imperial powers 100 years ago.
And that sounds like the George W. Bush doctrine.
Well, I mean, there were doctrines that got into conflict under the George W. Bush.
And let me say that I use the term doctrine loosely, but that sounds like George Bush's attitude, right, towards the end of his presidency, towards the Middle East?
Well, the doctrine I associate most with W. was preemption. If you can see a threat posed against the United States, you act before that threat can be activated. He saw Saddam Hussein as such a threat, though we now know that there weren't the weapons of mass destruction that Bush had feared were there. And in fairness to President Bush, neither was Hans Blix, the weapons inspector, convinced that the WMD was gone from Iraq. So they were suing for more time to look for it. But no, I mean, President George W. Bush acted on preemption. That's how we went to war without real cause in Iraq. But when it came to state building, you know, try to bring the parties together and let them find their own way forward. Perhaps, but we took a pretty heavy hand in state building in Iraq. We put our own people in to help them write their constitution, to hold the elections. We tried to shape Iraq in a democracy along lines that we were comfortable with. And as we've seen since then, the Iraqis have decided to kind of go their own way with that.
Let's talk about Erdogan for a minute. And if you could, we have you on, comment on the possible extradition of a Muslim cleric who's been in the United States for 20 years, who is a one-time ally of Erdogan and is now his nemesis. Do you have any comments on that? Is there a way to, you can maybe enlighten us on some of the some aspects of that relationship?
Well, I think you nailed it. Fethullah Gulen, who has been pretty much in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania, had been an influential partner with Erdogan's ruling AKP until quite recently. And you really had a clash between two parties that would have defined themselves as Islamist parties. And each had kind of taken zones of influence in modern Turkey. So the Gulenists were known to be very strong in the police, the army, the judiciary. And basically, the challenge they came to pose to AKP's single-handed control over Turkey made them shift from being allies to enemies. And that was nailed when in 2016, there was an attempted coup attempt on Erdogan and his government that was squarely blamed on Gulen and his followers. You know, Turkey's been pretty bad at providing a narrative of exactly what happened in that failed coup attempt. We don't really know who the ringleader is. We just know that they are blaming Gulen and his followers, and they have been pressing America for his extradition ever since. Now, I don't think that the Turkish standard of justice would match that the United States would expect from a country that it would respect extradition terms with. So, you know, the developments going on right now probably have more to do with the pressure that Turkey's exercising on Saudi Arabia and trying to cut a little slack on Turkey over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But I'd be surprised if Gulen gets extradited. And if he is extradited, I would not expect him to get full justice in Turkey. I think that he would be, you know, he would suffer a very unfair trial were he sent home.
Yeah, how should Americans feel about this? I mean, because he is in our country. Should we be outraged that it's even being considered that he's extradited? Or should we feel like, well, this is between Erdogan and the Turkish government and this cleric, and our government should negotiate whatever the right thing to do is?
You know, I just think that these kinds of internal Turkish political squabbles are so far from the interests of your average American, we really don't have a dog in that fight. I mean, what we have to remember with Turkey is, as a NATO ally, it is an important ally of the United States, and it's, you know, important situation. And we've got bases in Incirlik that we are very keen to keep rights to. So, you know, we want to stay on good terms with Turkey. In term, you know, relations have been strained in the past couple of years. But the bottom line, I guess, for American interests is that we respect our extradition treaties, but we only respect them in countries who have a level of justice that we're satisfied corresponds to our own.
So here you are. You've been brought in, the Strickland speaker. We've brought some amazing scholars in. You are one of them. You are someone who has lived all over the world. How did a young Eugene Rogan decide that he was going to become a history professor of your stature?
I don't know about the stature.
As I about stopped and was like, I think that I wanted to do that too.
You know, any that answer part. To that question, I am just hanging myself with all the rope you've just given me. But what I would say is I'm an accidental historian.
Okay.
You know, that was definitely not meant to be. As a young man, I grew up in the Middle East and in Europe. My dad worked in the aerospace industry. I got to Beirut when I was 10. We had to leave there because of an intense civil war that broke out in 1975. We moved then to Cairo. So I finished high school in Cairo and I came back to the States for university. I was fascinated by the Middle East already. I mean, those 7, 8 years I spent growing up are just the years when you become aware of the politics surrounding you. And the politics of the Middle East in the 70s were fascinating. But my plan was to go back to America, get a good degree, return to the Middle East, work in business, and get rich. My plan was to become a millionaire by the time I was 25. And I am a failure. But what happened is I went and did an economics degree. That was a big mistake. I was not a good economist. I did not like it. Decided to do a degree in Middle Eastern studies to prepare myself for that get rich quick experience in the Middle East. And that's when I first started studying history and found a subject that just totally fascinated me. And then decided to stay on a little longer and do a doctorate.
A little longer.
And by the time you've done a doctorate in history, you're basically suitable to either drive a taxi or teach at a university. I never got a job at a taxi, so I had to go work in a university.
And now you work at Oxford.
And now I work at Oxford, which was a very lucky break.
One thing, hey, Bob, I wanted you to hear this story because Eugene was telling me about this. When you were a student in Cairo, you ended up being part of an American band coming to play music in Cairo. Could you tell that story to everybody?
Well, the thing about Cairo in the 1970s was that it was a kind of wasteland of Western culture. I mean, there wasn't a record shop to be found anywhere. And as a teenager, you're desperate for any connection to the music world, rock and roll. There were rumors going around in my junior year in high school that Fleetwood Mac were coming. There were people even saying that they knew how to score tickets to this concert, okay? So when I heard from a buddy of mine whose dad worked for the United States Information Agency, the branch of the embassy that does cultural affairs, right. That the Grateful Dead were coming to Cairo.
Yes.
I was enough of a deadhead to get excited, but I was experienced enough of the disappointments of these fake rumors to like, I wanted proof.
Oh, poor little Eugenie's challenge.
The proof came when the Dead sent probably the most coherent member of the band, the one who could speak the most coherently for the band, to do all the diplomatic stuff with the Egyptian authorities, and that was bass player Phil Lesh. And so I got to interview Phil Lesh for my high school newspaper. I still got the issue. I even got the lead blocks we used to print it. So, you know, this is an object of great pride, and a signed bootleg copy of Terrapin Station with Phil Lesh saying, "Huge, come back in September." But the bad news was I graduated from high school in June, and in September I was in New York City starting as a freshman at Columbia, and I missed the Grateful Dead playing in Cairo. So the one time I could have scored great tickets, I was out of town. But I did get to meet the great man, and what a lovely guy Phil Lesh is. I still remember the couple hours we spent talking as just being totally awestruck. And I came up with the best headline for that article, which I would never be allowed to use today, which is "Grateful Dead to come to Cairo to play blues for Allah."
Oh, it's wonderful, wonderful story.
That's amazing. Bass player, you'd appreciate that one, Bob.
Yes, and I did have the opportunity to meet the great man, Phil Lesh, last year. It was very brief. but it was wonderful to shake his hand. And yes, I think that he was the most intellectually sound member of that organization. At least diplomatically. I think they all have their strengths. But yeah, I could see Phil being the more of the diplomat.
Yeah, he was great. And I've since heard there's a good recording of the concert.
Really?
So you can get a and there's a video of it. So
it is good, but you know, in dead lore and legend, it wasn't the best.
No.
It was the experience. It was more about the experience. So being in New York may have been you know, pretty good for you.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. No, I'm sorry to have missed them. It's true. Having listened to the recording, it wasn't them at their best. I think it's so much about a Dead concert.
They were
about
Egypt.
They were in Egypt. A distinct shortage of Deadheads, but they were picking up all the vibes of being in the pyramids.
Bill Walton was there, so that was good.
Well, Eugene Rogan, thank you so much for taking your morning out with us and coming to MTSU and being part of the Road to Now.
What can I say?
It was such a pleasure to speak with you today, and I'm glad you took some time to visit the Ryman. I'm sure Ben will show you around some more, and I'm sure you guys will have a great time. Thank you so much.
Well, I know I'm coming back to when I come back to Nashville. But thank you both very much. It's been a real enhancement of my Nashville experience to get to talk to you too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is produced by Ben Sawyer and Bob Crawford. Today's episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. We want to thank our Patreon members for their continued support. A special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Peggy Donica, Jeff LeCane, and Fig White. To join our team of patrons and get extra content, you can go to patreon.com/theroadtonow or just go to theroadtonow.com, our website, and click on the support tab at the top of our page. If you're unable to support us financially, that's okay. We've all been there before. You can still support us, though, by telling a friend about our podcast and by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. That only takes a few minutes, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. Today's music, like almost always, is by the talented and lovely Paul DeFiglia. For the Road to Now crew, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.